This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Claire Nichols, and on this episode of The Book Show, fun is the word of the day. I'm bringing you stories of city-saving superheroes, cheese-binging record store employees, and a chemist turned TV chef. And yeah, there's darkness and nuance to these books too. Plenty for us to get our teeth into. But I am promising you, for the next hour, plenty of laughter and light. And don't we need that? So, on the lineup today, Vonnie Garmus will tell you about her hit novel, Lessons in Chemistry. The Australian writer Catherine Pollock will recount her record store days in Her Fidelity. But right now, it's N.K. Jemisin and The World We Make. This is a novel about superheroes. To be more specific, a group of New Yorkers with incredible powers acting as human avatars for the living, breathing city itself. The author, N.K. Jemisin, is something of a superhero herself when it comes to the world of fantasy writing. She is the only person ever to win 3 Hugo Awards for Best Novel in a row for her acclaimed Broken Earth series. You might remember me talking to Nora about the first book in this new series a couple of years ago. It was such a great chat, and you can find it in the Book Show archive. And right now, Nora joins me again. Hi, Nora.
Hi, how are you?
I'm so well. Glad we get to chat again, especially because the last time we spoke, it was right at the start of the pandemic. I think you were one of my first at-home interviews. You were in your socks. I was in my socks. And it was such a weird, weird time to be talking.
It was. And now we're used to it. So, yeah, I was really hoping that we would be done with it by then. But oh, well.
Yeah, because I remember at that time when we spoke, New York was really the epicenter of the COVID pandemic. I mean, it was so bad. What is it like now? It's not like back to normal, right?
No, and I don't think we're going to get back to normal since people just refuse to do anything that is helpful for stopping the transmission and generation of new variants. So we've had a few New York-specific variants. So yeah, it's just not going to get any better.
So do you get out much, Nora? Or are you mainly at home?
No, I get out. I mask religiously, but you know, it's gotten to the point where, what are we, 3 years on now, nearly, and it's just not getting any better. Plus, this is a city. I need to be out. I have to go places to do things. You know, it's not like I can be self-sufficient here. So, you know, I go out to get groceries. I go out with friends. We just do outdoor gatherings instead of indoor, which becomes a little difficult now that winter is back. But we'll just have to try and make that work as best we can.
I love hearing you talk about your city because you are so passionate about it. And that's really what this series is all about. The first book in the series was called The City We Became. Perhaps, Nora, you can remind people of the basics for this. How do a bunch of New Yorkers become avatars for a city?
Well, the premise of the story or premise of the duology is that when cities achieve a certain kind of critical mass, it is cultural, it is legendary, or the things that people say and think and believe about a city. Size, of course, but also, you know, its impact on culture and impact on the world. When a city achieves that mass, then it kind of goes through a transformation and it stops just being a collection of buildings and becomes sentient and is able to act in its own defense in subtle and sometimes unsubtle ways. And so, you know, the city then selects one human being or several human beings to represent it and direct its power. Cities being gigantic things, they can't really you know, it's kind of like the dog that needs help finding a single flea on its back. So it's got a human for that. So that's basically what's happening, is that in this particular case, first the city awakened a single person to be the avatar of all New York. And when that turned out to be not quite enough, it then awakened the five boroughs of New York City. That's Brooklyn, Manhattan, Staten Island, Queens, and the Bronx.
New York is such a particular place, but those five boroughs are such particular places too. Is that why a city like New York needs several avatars, when maybe a city like London might just need one?
Well, but London actually turns out to have even more avatars than New York. So, yeah, it depends on the city. Some cities, you know, I've lived in various cities over the course of my life. I've lived in cities that just kind of were a single city that just grew and grew and grew. And I've lived in others that were multiple cities that all just sort of grew together. Small villages that got big and just sort of blended into each other. Basically, that's what New York is. And so, you know, because they all started as individual separate cities, and because they've all kind of retained some of that unique separate character, there's drastic differences between the boroughs of New York. If it was a slight difference, then a single avatar might have been chosen. But in the case of New York, where, you know, you've got super urban boroughs like Manhattan right across literally right across New York Harbor from Staten Island, which is covered in farms, you know, those are different enough that each one deserves its own avatar.
And if I remember rightly, you live in Brooklyn, right, Nora?
I do.
So is your allegiance lying there? Are you finding you're favoring Brooklyn when you're writing this series?
No, actually, I on purpose, because I had to deal with the fact that I am enough of a New Yorker to have New York biases, I tried to deliberately like decenter my favorite borough. Brooklyn is my favorite borough. But in the first book, she's, you know, one of the more secondary characters. I decided to sort of center the first book of the duology on Manhattan and Staten Island, and kind of to a lesser degree, Queens. In the second book, then, and I ended up sort of centering Queens and the Bronx a little bit more and Brooklyn a little bit more. And that was just because I didn't want to, you know, sort of make everything all about like what I like about New York. I wanted to tell what is actually true about New York, to the degree that any individual human being can do.
Mm-hmm. Nora, I hope we can go back to the genesis of this series. This came off the back of the Broken Earth trilogy, which was such a big, important series. And from memory, this was originally about doing something kind of fun, right?
Yeah. And that is what it kind of ended up being. After the Broken Earth books, which came out of my deep frustration and anger with sort of seeing the beginnings or the sort of ramp up of America's rapid turn to fascism, which I assume that the rest of the world is sadly aware of. You know, as I started to see these things happening with increasing degrees, and also on a personal level, I was dealing with the fact that my mother was beginning to deteriorate, and she passed away in 2017 while I was working on the third book of the series. So because I had been dealing with such heavy themes, with racism, with systemic bigotry, with kind of contemplating an entire society built on the exploitation of some other groups of people. At that point, I needed a break. I wanted something more lighthearted, something fun, something positive and sort of generally uplifting. And, you know, the sort of silly idea of what if New York was, you know, kind of like a giant robot with individual you know, avatars that could join together and form like Voltron to fight terrible existential evil. I am a silly person. I have a silly sense of humor. And that was basically where I was like, okay, this sounds absolutely stupid. I've got to write it. So that was it.
And it is so fun, but I do think that those ideas you were talking about with the Broken Earth series, your concerns about America and the world, they do still find their way into these books, don't they? So I was wondering if the fun stayed there in the writing, or those concerns that keep you up at night, you know, just had to work their way into these books.
Well, the story became less fun in the second book and more, I guess, sort of a call for people to work together, a call for something better. You know, it became fewer jokes, fewer, you know, just bits of silliness, you know, and really just kind of turned into, look, we've got to work together. We've got this huge problem. We've got to reach out for allies outside of our own circle of people. We've got to, you know, actually plan. We've got to actually do something about this. We can't just passively wait for things to get worse and worse and worse until, you know, the end. And maybe we're doomed, but damn it, we've got to fight to try and, you know, retain what we've got as best we can. And, you know, I guess that's another way of dealing with the stress of all of the things that are happening in the country.
Mm. And politics finds its way quite explicitly into this second book in the series. So we've got a couple of different kind of bad guys. We've got the extra dimensional bad guy in a character called the Woman in White. But then in the kind of real world, we are facing a really awful mayoral candidate, a guy called Ruben Panfilo. Who is he?
Well, Panfilo is actually meant to be an amalgamation of several New York politicians. You know, New York kind of gets a sort of undeserved reputation for being this extremely liberal city, and it's not true. We have this giant right-wing faction of the city, and the suburbs just outside the city exert a lot of influence, and they tend to be much more conservative as well. And so, you know, New York has always had just a slew of, you know, really kind of horrific politicians, people who would, if they could, destroy the city in order to gain power over the city. Because in a city like New York, you cannot have, you know, the degree of ethnic and economic and you know, other cultural conflicts that our politicians seem to love to fan the flames of. You can't have that and have the city still function. The city would explode. And so, you know, a lot of these politicians are willing to exploit bigotry and hatred for short-term political gain, you know, and they don't really care about the long-term implications of what they're doing. So, as I was writing the book, we were going through a mayoral race for New York City, and we did have several candidates who were kind of frightening, and sadly, one of them got hired. I'm sorry, elected. So, you know, I guess I was working with, well, at least in my head, the campaign can go better. you know, basically what I was trying to do was rerun reality through my own wish fulfillment filter. So I'm not even going to pretend that I wasn't just kind of hoping that for better and writing better into existence in the hopes that it would actually occur.
In the book, there is this kind of hatred spreading across the city. But we get the sense in the novel that perhaps this extra dimensional monster might be responsible for some of those awful thoughts that people are having. I wondered if that's a bit of an easier pill to swallow than accepting that hatred really just does come from people all on their own.
Well, I did try to make it clear that the Woman in White only went where she was welcome, basically. To sort of explain it, the Woman in White is a Lovecraftian entity, effectively. Lovecraft is not actually present here in the story, but, you know, there's a lot of mentions of it, and I am actively engaging with Lovecraftian mythos in some ways. But the Woman in White is an entity from beyond this world whose purpose is to destroy cities when they awaken and become living cities. She can do that in one of two ways. She can manifest as, you know, giant tentacle monsters and just smash things. But that got averted in the very beginning of the first book. So that's not really a spoiler. That happens basically in the prologue of the first book. And so, you know, she's prevented from doing the sort of macro scale destruction that she tried to do. And in lieu of that, she attempts to weaken cities by emphasizing and fanning the flames of racial hatred, socioeconomic strife and inequality, gentrification, things of that nature, because those are the forces that work against a city's, you know, sort of health. And so I wanted to kind of explore the ways in which a city could push back against these homogenizing factors and so on. But one of the homogenizing factors is the politicians that we have that are willing to throw the city's unity under the bus in order to you know, score some short-term gain in terms of votes. And so, you know, the woman in white basically decides she's going to endorse a mayoral candidate. and it goes from there.
And we did talk in quite a lot of detail about the Lovecraftian influence on this series in the last conversation we had. So I will point people back to that chat in the Book Show archive if they want to hear more about the really fascinating way Nora's been inspired by, or inspired or repelled by, Lovecraft. But Nora, tell me about building a fantasy world in a real city. I'm sure there's some people who would think that must be much easier. You already have a world in place. But what are the challenges with setting a fantasy series in the real world?
Well, first and foremost, the real world steals your ideas. So the Great Cities set of books was originally going to be a trilogy. It is now a duology. And that is because after I wrote the first book and it came out in the middle of the pandemic, basically at the beginning of the pandemic, New York went through a lot of changes. It is still going through those changes. And those changes are affecting its culture, its politics, you know, its physicality in a number of ways and so on. And my original plan for the second book of the series would have been the city needed to sort of band together and face a presidential candidate or a president who had decided to target New York City and sort of vilify the city as a symbol of everything that's wrong with liberalism, yada, yada, yada. And then Donald Trump did that. So at that point, when I began to realize, you know what, I can't keep engaging with politics, you know, to quite the same degree. I can't keep it realistic because I don't know what the heck is going to happen. I mean, having Trump for a president meant just basically living in a constant like roll of the dice. And so there was no way that I could kind of plan around actual real politics. So I ended up having to focus on fake politics and make up my own mayor's race. So that was basically it.
Wow. Disappointing to have a trilogy go down to a duology.
Yeah. And the idea was at that point that I can sort of compress it a little bit. And, you know, I had intended to still try and do three books, but once I took out what would have been the plot of the middle book, which, like I said, got stolen by Donald Trump, once I took out, I'm joking about that, obviously, I'm going to sue him for idea theft. Anyway, so once that plot got stolen, then I was left with, you know, a lot of material, but not enough for three books. So I just squished them together at that point.
Politics is obviously a big concern in this book, but another thing that you seem to want to talk about is the gentrification of your city. How much has it changed just in your lifetime?
Well, when I was a child living in New York, that was the late 70s or so, the city was nearly bankrupt. It was struggling to maintain a tax base because of a lot of its population had basically done white flight out to the suburbs, taking, you know, a lot of money with them. But at the same time, what was left in the city were kind of like just a population of scrappy dreamers, artists, you know, that kind of thing. There's a reason that New York City became the capital of the art world for a while. I don't think it is anymore, but it was at that time. It was the capital of fashion. It was a place where people could come and just create, and there were industries and businesses to support all of that. Now, by the same token, the city was struggling financially. You know, there was a lot of urban blight. The crack epidemic was happening. So we had, you know, crack vials all over the place. It was just, it was a mix of good and bad. And all cities go through change. I'm by no means suggesting that New York's improvement, because on a lot of levels, the city is much better than it was. Crime is down. There's no more urban blight, and so on. The catch is the creativity is dwindling. Artists can't afford to live here anymore. And what is replacing it is that we are now the city of, you know, high finance. I guess we were always that because of Wall Street, but it's basically nothing but finance and real estate now. And there are still artists here. You know, a lot of them are kind of just hanging on by the skin of their teeth, but it's, you know, it's a little bit of a sad loss, because when you lose the ability for just regular working class people to live here easily, then you start to have a city that is struggling to have like just basic resources. You know, if we don't do something, then we won't have garbage people. We won't have teachers. We won't have plumbers because they can't afford to live here. And so that's kind of what the issue is.
It's probably no accident that the avatar for New York City itself, the number one avatar, is an artist. And it's really important to him that he has to stay dirty. He talks about the smells of fermenting piss, rat poison, and ozone. And Nora, yeah. You somehow make those horrible smells sound kind of romantic and beautiful.
Well, I mean, New York is gross. I have to admit it. It's just a filthy city. You know, American cities basically are running on a shoestring budget, and we don't believe in doing basic things like paying for infrastructure. So, you know, we've got this 100 plus year old subway system, one of the first in the country, and it looks like it and it smells like it and it barely functions. It constantly catches fire. You know, I mean, there are aspects of New York City that are just, you have to love them if you live here, because the alternative is losing your mind. So I don't want to gloss over the fact that New York has a lot of problems. But at the same time, some of that is part of New York City. A lot of that is just simply part of being America. But New York is the epicenter of a lot of things that are sort of quintessentially American, like decaying infrastructure. So I just wanted to bring that in there.
The other thing I love about this series is just how you embrace what can be a very mundane life, even if you are a superhero. So the avatars for the city are, they're saving New York, but, you know, they're also worrying about their jobs and their studies, how to make rent. At one point, they have a Zoom meeting to catch up, and that made me laugh.
Yeah. The Zoom meeting gets Zoom bombed by the woman in white. So it turns into an eldritch horror Zoom meeting. So I had a lot of fun writing that.
You are not writing a third book in this series, Nora. So tell me what is happening for you now. I know there's a TV adaptation of the Broken Earth trilogy on the way. Where are you at?
Well, okay, a couple of things. First, I did leave a door open on possibly writing a third book. At the time that I started working on the second book, I wasn't feeling it. But my love for this series got kind of prematurely cut off by real world events. So I decided to leave a door open. There is an element that I cannot speak to without spoilers, but there is an element of the story that is an obvious place that I can continue it if I do decide to do so. But for right now, I'm not planning to. So you'd mentioned that it was a TV adaptation of The Broken Earth. It's actually a film. And so I am on board writing the script for this film. I've already turned in my final draft of that, or my third draft of that. It is going to a more experienced Hollywood screenplay writer who will start turning it into the kind of script that directors and actors need to see. There's a whole new ecosystem of writing in screenplay writing, and I am just now beginning to learn it and get used to it. So I actually asked for someone to assist with this so that it wouldn't be just me, because I don't know what I'm doing. It is trial by fire. I'm learning as fast as I can. So just wanted to clarify that.
And what about the Great City series? Has that been optioned for the screen?
It is a thing that I cannot discuss right now because it's in process. Yeah, sorry. Until the contract is signed, I feel like I shouldn't talk about it. But good things are happening. We'll just leave it at that.
Well, I can see this as a really enjoyable TV series or a film, so I hope that does happen. But in the meantime, of course, we have these fabulous books to read. They are called The City We Became and The World We Make, and they're published here in Australia by Hachette. N.K. Jemisin, it's been so great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
How do you move on when you're in a rut? Catherine Pollock asks this question in her funny debut novel, Her Fidelity. It's about Kathy, who's worked in a record store since she was a teen, but now at 30, is starting to think she needs something else. The question is, how to find out what that something is? Producer Sarah Lestrange is with Catherine Pollock.
Catherine Pollock has worked in indie record stores for a long time.
So I've worked in independent record stores for about nearly 20 years in total. I've only just sort of stopped working in a kind of a casual way in a record store as of the last few months. So it's only quite recently that sort of chapter of my life has, I wouldn't even necessarily say shut, but, you know, temporarily closed. And aside from that, just a big, you know, big music fan, big music nerd as well.
And when Catherine worked in record stores, she says most customers were fine.
Most customers are, you know, neutral to lovely, I would say. And, you know, very much just there because they want the particular record or they want to have a chat and, you know, be in that sort of environment.
But some were rude.
Most of the time this doesn't occur, but it's certainly not something that I'm unfamiliar with. And it can be from just sort of low level microaggressions, you know, doubting that you know what you're on about or that you're there for the quote unquote right reasons, through to more overt sort of hostility and harassment, less frequently, but, you know, certainly impactfully when it has happened.
The subtext being, you're a woman, what do you know about music?
Yeah, precisely. You know, that you're sort of there, you know, in that space wearing that band t-shirt to, you know, impress a boy or, you know, that you're just sort of pretending and you don't have a right to be in that space for any number of entirely false reasons.
Catherine Pollock has channeled these experiences into her debut novel, Her Fidelity. It stars Kathy, who's a longtime worker at Dusty's Records in Brisbane and has now reached 30 and can be a frustrating character at times.
She certainly drinks too much, eats too much cheese and takes too long to come to some decisions. That's, I think, a fair condemnation or criticism.
But part of this frustration is because Kathy doesn't even realise when she's being mistreated. She's the one who vacuums the store, she does the coffee run, and she gets no support from her male colleagues when customers behave badly.
It wasn't an unintentional choice for me to make her that slightly older age and to make her sort of so stubborn and resistant and almost willfully ignorant at times. I wanted to show how we often normalize and internalize a lot of what we go through to show just how long and fraught and non-linear those journeys of reckoning can be. I think perhaps whether it was conscious or not, when I was writing this book, I was reflecting on some of the conversations I had post Me Too of women my age and quite a bit older as well who had only in, you know, across that time, that sort of Me Too first burst of testimony and people talking about things actually come to grips themselves with what had happened, you know, whether or not they were still in some of those sort of spaces that a lot of people I know hadn't really accepted or dealt with, you know, or even allowed their own anger or sadness at some of those situations. So while it was like a lot of things in this book, you know, almost comically exaggerated, it was also me trying to realistically depict how it's not this sort of mapped out linear progression from, you know, you experience a trauma or whatever it might be to, you know, immediately resolving it and being your best self. It can be a lot messier and longer than that.
And And in case you're wondering, her fidelity is a nod to High Fidelity.
I'm actually quite a big fan of kind of all of Nick Hornby's work, truthfully, but particularly High Fidelity, the book, and I'm quite a fan of the movie.
A quick recap. High Fidelity is English author Nick Hornby's 1995 hit novel about Rob Fleming, who owns Championship Vinyl Record Store, and it's about his top five breakups.
But it's, you know, as readers would fairly swiftly find out, an entirely different story. So it was really just a bit of a sort of a cheeky allusion rather than anything like an homage, and certainly not a takedown. So I was a little hesitant that some people may think it was on either end of that spectrum, whereas, you know, to me, it was just a fairly satisfying pun with, I will say, a deliberate meaning underneath, you know, that of amplifying women's perspectives, particularly those in music.
Like High Fidelity, though, her fidelity is funny.
As a pop culture consumer, I suppose, generally speaking, I love humour and comedy, particularly when it's, you know, levity amongst darkness. I think it's just so invaluable. It, you know, it gives us reprieve and catharsis and solidarity and joy in amongst the otherwise, you know, often feeling mired in bleakness.
Welcome to Dusty's Records in Brisbane.
Walking down the stairs into Dusty's, careful, don't slip on the spilled Slurpee on the third step, you enter a musty basement with flickering fluorescent lights and a vague aura of despair. Or maybe that's just the black mould. A shelving system that seems designed to actively prevent customers from finding things means you should be prepared to allow at least half an hour more than you think you'll need for crate digging. If you do find a record and decide to buy it, be prepared to wait even longer for service at the front counter. The staff aren't busy, but you'll damn well feel like you've interrupted them unduly, and you'll pay. Specifically, a 20% markup. Finally, clutching your bagged item, you'll find yourself at the top of the stairs, blinking in the sudden glare of sunshine on cement, the record you bought already warping in the humidity. You'll stagger around the corner to the bus stop, perplexed as to how 5 hours have gone by.
You can just smell it, can't you, with that description? In fact, I've read quite a few humorous books by Australian women just this year, by Toni Jordan, Megan Albany, Catherine Collette and Diana Reid, and Her Fidelity is another to add to the list.
I suppose I've always tried to be funny, would maybe be too conscious way of framing it, but both in my kind of everyday life and as a writer, I've just always sort of tried to strike that balance of, you know, some degree of seriousness or poignancy or whatever it might be, depending on the piece, with humour. So I don't sort of recall a time in which I didn't do it, but I can recall times in which I tried to write much more poetically and seriously, and it was unintentionally funny in a bad way. So much better for me to embrace the silliness of my natural voice, I think.
Catherine Pollock with Sarah Lestrange. Her Fidelity is published by Vintage. Now, normally on The Book Show, I am telling you what to read with interviews about the very latest books to hit the shelves. But right now, I am switching things up and taking a recommendation from you. I have been hearing such great things about Bonnie Garmus's novel Lessons in Chemistry for close to a year now. I have had booksellers corner me to rave about it. It's been a constant favourite in our ABC Book Club Facebook group. So this week, finally, I got around to reading it, and I'm so pleased to say that Bonnie Garmus is here with me to talk about it. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, thank you for inviting me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, this is really special. This book has been such a hit. Did you guess when you were writing it that people would really connect with the story?
No, I thought just the opposite, that it was odd enough that it might be a very hard sell.
Yeah, so it's about a woman called Elizabeth Zott. She's a single mother and she's a chemist in 1960s America. For a bunch of reasons, she can't do her job and she ends up hosting a TV cooking show. Can we go back to the beginning? Bonnie, where did this all begin? Where did this start?
Well, it started actually with a pretty bad mood. I was having trouble at work. I'd had a bad day at work. I'd been in a meeting where I'd just experienced the normal, the normal sexism, misogyny, which I think so many women experience being talked over, except that day my ideas for a campaign had also been stolen by someone in the room. I was in a meeting with all men. And even though I objected, no one listened to me. So when I went back to my desk, instead of working, I wrote the first chapter of Lessons in Chemistry.
That's nice revenge. Don't do your job. Do something else. So you were working as a copywriter at the time. Is that right?
Yes, copywriter, creative director. So I was launching a campaign for a big technology company. And, I've been doing it for a long time. And I couldn't believe that day how flagrant the sexism was in that room.
Oh, it sounds absolutely infuriating. But how did you go from that to writing about, of all things, chemistry?
Oh, well, so I had another novel that I'd started a long, long time ago, and Elizabeth Zott had been in that novel. I'd never finished that novel, and it was, I'd abandoned it. She was only in there for a paragraph, but in that novel, she was a chemist. And so that day when I sat down to write her, she was still a chemist. And I felt like she was talking to me about how things had been much worse for her in the 50s and the 60s, and she had a story to tell. I just wasn't sure what the story was. So I had to spend a few years finding that out.
What did you know about chemistry, Bonnie?
Essentially nothing. Copywriters always write what they don't know, which is the opposite advice of what everyone in the writing world will give you. But I think it's very good advice to write what you don't know, because that way you have to teach yourself things that you wouldn't have encountered before. But I have to admit that having her be a chemist turned out to be a little bit harder than I thought to learn chemistry. So there were a couple times while I was writing it where I thought, why didn't I make her a historian? It turned out great because I really needed to learn that chemistry to understand how the world actually works. And I did have to keep it within the time frame of 1951 to 1962, and that was hard.
So how do you do that? Do you go to the library and find an old book?
I got one off of eBay, and I taught myself basic chemistry. Heavy emphasis on basic.
Basic chemistry from the 1950s. Is it still pretty solid, or has a lot changed?
Well, science marches on every single day. We discover something new every single day. So yes, the periodic table from the 1950s is quite different from the periodic table from 2022. We've discovered new elements, and we know so much more about the interactions between atoms and molecules and how things are balanced. Science moves on.
Okay, let's talk about Elizabeth Zott. Obviously, she made an impact on you in that one paragraph in that other book. And I'm not surprised because she's such an intelligent character. She's passionate about her work. But she has, I'd have to say, almost no sense of humour whatsoever. How would you describe this woman you've created?
Well, I totally agree with you. She has no sense of humor. What Elizabeth Zott is, she's a catalyst. So everyone who comes in contact with her will change. She does not really change very much. But I would say that she is a stoic, a rationalist. She's actually fashioned upon the ideas of Stoicism. So Marcus Aurelius wrote about Stoicism and how Stoics are very brave and courageous. They're also very rational, and they always listen to people, but they do not accept everything that they hear because they need evidence for things, and they demand evidence. They're very logical.
Okay. Her views on the world are quite progressive, I think, especially for her time and place. I mean, how do you make sense of that, Bonnie, this woman from Middle America who is so switched on to things like women's rights, the wrongs of racism, even, I guess, the concept of Stoicism?
Oh, well, I think women back then did go to college and they were fairly well educated, but they didn't work because they weren't allowed to work. They weren't encouraged to work. And it was, I think for her, it would be you know, she was obviously very well read. She is self-educated, which is something that I think I really wanted to get across in the book, that even if you can't afford a school, there is a library. And the library holds these jewels that can teach you nearly everything that, you would want to know about or learn. And there's so much discovery for people. So I would say, you know, that's really where she comes from. And those ideas, those philosophies were in play back then. A lot of people were reading philosophy back then, as they do now.
Mm. So Elizabeth ends up hosting this TV show. It's called Supper at Six. And when you consider the character of Elizabeth Zott, this very no-nonsense woman and this kind of glittery afternoon TV show, you couldn't imagine a worse fit, really. What is she like? What is she like as a presenter?
Oh, okay. So she is, like you said, she is no-nonsense. In a way, she just doesn't put up with anything frivolous. She's just not interested in that kind of thing. She's interested in pursuing something that matters. And to her, she wants to teach the women at home that when they cook, it's not simply that they're putting a meal on the table. They are actually performing and experimenting chemistry in their kitchens. And when you fail at chemistry, then you produce a less than, you know, good meal. But when you perform well at chemistry, you are called a chef. And so she wanted women to understand that chemistry is the basis for all things in the world. It's what rules the world. And it also is what rules us. We are chemical beings. I loved writing a character who was so serious because it allows everyone around her to react in ways that allow, you know, comedy.
It did make me feel a bit more powerful when I went and baked a cake after reading this book.
Great.
She's speaking to this audience of housewives. Elizabeth Zott, she is a mother. She does cook for her family every night. She is unmarried. Does she feel like she's one of the women she is speaking to?
You know, I think Elizabeth Zott had no intention of being one of those women. I even think that she may have kind of looked down on those women until she accidentally became one of them. And then she realized just how difficult their roles were at home, just how difficult that job was, raising a child and doing all the work at home and working on top of that. And so when she goes on her show and she approaches these women, it's with renewed respect for who they are and what they've had to give up in order to stay home and be this ideal but average housewife.
You know, I've seen so many people call Lessons in Chemistry a feel-good book, and it was certainly so enjoyable to read. It's got this beautiful, bright cover, but I was surprised by how much darkness there is in this book, Bonnie. Elizabeth has experienced so much trauma in her life. And when the book opens, I mean, she's a deeply depressed woman, right?
She's absolutely deeply depressed. I think that, you know, she does have to face incredible hurdles in her life. My intention when I was writing her was to see how she handles the worst that life can hand you. How does somebody get from 0 to 10 like she has done? I think it's because for her, she stays true to herself. She knows who she is. She knows what she needs to do. And she just hangs on to who she is. She does not worry so much about what other people think of her or anything like that, because she knows that society is ruled by a bunch of old stories that people created thousands of years ago. And she refuses to accept those stories into her life. And that's where her courage comes from. She's simply rational.
This is your debut novel, and I'm really interested in how you found the balance in this book, knowing where to toe the line between all the joy and humor in this book and figure out how much you could actually put Elizabeth through.
Well, you know, when I was writing it, I had in mind, it's very important not to be didactic, because you can come off being preachy and being too forceful. Life is difficult for almost everyone in some specific way. And I think if we can find a way to introduce humor into that, it's a salve to our souls. And so when there is darkness, there has to be also lightness, because otherwise, if the world just is just completely dark, it's very hard to keep going. And we all need to keep going. So that's why I was pretty careful. I tried to be very careful to balance these things. There's probably more humor than darkness, but the darkness is so dark that that was the balance, more humor around it.
Yeah. You've said you didn't want to be didactic. Do you see Lessons in Chemistry as a feminist novel?
Yeah, I think it's a feminist novel. Actually, sometimes I call it an equalist novel, because there are men in this novel who are really great men, you know, Calvin Evans, Walter Pine, Reverend Wakely, the reporter Roth, etc. These men who are back then, even back then, are women allies. And back then, of course, we wouldn't have called them that. But I think even back then, we had men who questioned the status quo themselves, who question it today. And so that's why the book is finally and starting to find an enormous amount of male readers, because they also see themselves as victims of a society that tells them they have to be a certain way that they don't feel super comfortable with. On the other hand, it is definitely a feminist novel, because women are still being held back today all over the world.
Mm. I'm glad you mentioned Calvin Evans, because he is a brilliant man in a book that does have some really rotten men in it. Tell me about Calvin and Elizabeth's relationship with him.
Oh, it was so much fun to write that. Calvin Evans is a brilliant scientist. He, you know, is on the brink of winning the Nobel Prize. Nobody likes him. They're all afraid of him. And then Elizabeth Zott comes into his life and he changes, because she's a catalyst. He changes and he realizes, you know, that he is attracted to her, not because she's beautiful. He's attracted to her mind. It's the very first person in his life he's ever been able to have a conversation with, ever been able to be understood by. And it's the same for her. And so writing that relationship was really, really great for me. I really enjoyed having them, you know, communicate with each other and have their passion for science and for each other on display, you know, for a certain amount of time.
Passion for science, passion for each other, also perhaps a passion for rowing. Calvin introduces Elizabeth to rowing, which I've got to say, Bonnie Garmus, you make sound like the most painful, awful, yet somehow wonderful sport in the whole world. Tell me about your relationship with rowing.
Well, you just gave the perfect encapsulation of rowing. It's incredibly fun, but also very painful. And I think rowing, I have rowing in the book, A, because I'm a rower, and I had to put something in the book that I knew about firsthand. But B, because rowing requires perfect balance. Chemistry requires perfect balance. And yet in our workplaces, we don't have balance. In our world, we don't have balance. And so I wanted to juxtapose rowing against the typical workplace. Rowing requires cooperation between everyone in the boat to be a certain way in order to reach a goal, to have perfect communication through sound and through movement. And it occurred to me that if we had that kind of cooperation in the workplace, where we didn't care what someone's gender was or race or anything, that we would all be moving forward faster.
Oh, I like that analogy. How long have you rowed for?
I came to it late. I started rowing when I was 36, and now I'm, how old am I? I'm 65. So about 30 years I've been rowing.
And I was actually scared to ask you about it, because as you say in the book, one of the worst things about rowers is they only want to talk about rowing, right?
Rowing.
What do you,
right.
But what do you get out of it?
There's this sense of accomplishment with rowing where you challenge yourself to go beyond what you think your limits are. The book is all about breaking through the limits that society has set for us. Rowing forces you to do that. And the reason why and the way it does that is because you have to support the other rowers in the book. You have to give it your all every time to row. I mean, you can phone it in some days, but everyone in the boat knows if you're doing that. They can feel it. So there's a pressure in rowing to be at your best and to set your ego aside and help your other teammates move that boat. And so rowing is a strange sport, but when you do it well, it feels like the boat is flying and that it's effortless. And then you get to the finish line and you're drenched in sweat and you can't breathe and you think, that was the best time of my life.
Wow, that's awesome. There's a really fabulous dog in your book. He's called 630. So smart, most incredible dog. We're often seeing things from his perspective. Where does the name 630 come from?
The name 630 comes from 630's misunderstanding of how he got named. He follows Elizabeth Holmes. He sees her and he follows her home from a grocery store. And Calvin calls out to her from a window, "Who's that?" And she misunderstands and she thinks he's asking for the time. And she says, "It's 630. And then 630 decides that that's how people and animals come into a family. They're given the name at which time they have joined the family. So they're given a timed name.
And you had a dog called Friday. So do you get your dog on a Friday? Is this where this comes from?
No, we got her on a Saturday.
What?
My kids named her Friday. I know.
And how did this dog Friday actually influence the character of 630?
Well, honestly, Friday is 630. We didn't set out to teach 630 words. I mean, to teach Friday words, sorry. But she turned out to be a really, really bright dog. We used to think at first that she was just trying to please us because we'd rescued her. You know, the standard idea of how dogs learn or how they behave. But in fact, Friday soon showed us that she was not the average dog. And I get a feeling no dog is average, just like there is no such thing as an average housewife. Anyway, Friday used to watch our mouths all the time. She used to stare at us. And she started picking up language very quickly. And she would demonstrate to us how much she knew by retrieving something in the house that we had been talking about. A toy, or one time I couldn't find my keys and I said out loud, "I don't know where my keys are." And she went and looked through my briefcase, my gym bag, all my pockets of my jackets, found my keys, and threw them on the floor in front of my feet. When we were transferred abroad, Friday learned German. I'm not even kidding you. So I think, you know, dogs can really learn a lot. And there was a very famous dog named Casper who knew over 1,000 words.
So in your novel, Friday becomes 630. And what experiment is Elizabeth Zott running with 630 in terms of his understanding of English?
I think for Elizabeth Zott, she refuses to accept limits for anyone, and that includes her dog. And so she reads out loud. She reads out loud Moby Dick and things like this. She just assumes, she decides that everyone, be them, you know, an animal, well, we're animals as well, but whether they're a dog or a human or a housewife that's been overlooked or a small child, everyone is capable of great amounts of learning. The reason why we all don't learn as much is because we're held back. We're told, "You're too young, you're too old, you're a dog." You know, all of these are limits set by old ideas and other people, but they're not true.
Of course not. Bonnie Garmus, Lessons in Chemistry is your debut novel. You told us that you're 65 years old. Do you see your age as an advantage here? I'm just wondering if that experience helps you to write a better book.
Oh, thanks for asking that. You know, I'm not entirely sure. I've been writing a long time as a copywriter. I write every day. But I do think that when you get a little bit older, you sit back and you look a little more carefully. You have more experience. You can look at the things that are going around in the world and you begin to see more and more connections between things that maybe I wouldn't have been able to see in my 20s or my 30s without that extra experience. So I think in some way, the age has just been a huge boon for me. You know, I still have the same energy that I had when I was 30, but I think better, which is a huge relief at 65, believe me.
The book is Lessons in Chemistry. It's published by Doubleday. Bonnie Garmus, it's been wonderful to meet you today.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And you have been listening to The Book Show, made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. I'm Claire Nichols. Take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.